I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. Patagonia is one of the leading outdoor apparel companies known for its social and environmental responsibility, as well as its fashionable fleece jackets and long underwear. My guest is the founder of Patagonia, Yvonne Chouinard. In addition to starting Patagonia, Yvonne is an avid mountaineer, fly fisher, and blacksmith.
I mean, some people approach Zen Buddhism by meditating. I kind of approach it through action, and I've applied it in all my sports and applied it in business. Like, for instance, if you ask me what our profits were last year, I completely forgot. I have no idea what they were. I have no idea what they're going to be this year. I couldn't care less. I'm focused on the process. And if you focus on the process of business, the profits come.
Coming up, we'll learn how Yvonne Chouinard's love of mountaineering led him to build Patagonia from scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Yvonne Chouinard, founder of the outdoor apparel company Patagonia. Yvonne started Patagonia in 1973, and the company exemplifies social and environmental responsibility. Some of its efforts include donating 1% of sales to environmental efforts, making its cotton sportswear 100% organic, having a child care center on its premises, and reducing its energy use by 60%. In addition to being the founder of Patagonia, Yvonne is a rock climber, surfer, and fly fishing enthusiast. Welcome.
Thank you.
I want to talk about falconry because that really is the germ or the origination for Patagonia, ultimately, indirectly. Where did your interest in falconry come from when you were in your teens?
Well, I think it was just early teens, in fact. I don't know. I read a National Geographic article from a 1920 Geographic by the Frank and John Craighead about hawks and falcons, and I just got interested in it. And I got in with some other young fellows, and we started kind of a little club of falconers and would go around and climbing to hawks' nests and taking birds and training them, and then, but also banding birds for the U.S. government and stuff.
Now, this was in Southern California?
Yeah.
Your family lived in Maine before moving to Southern California. Why did they move?
Yeah. Well, we moved when I was about 7 years old because my father had asthma, and my mother thought the climate would be better for him in California.
And for the first 7 years of your life, you went to a French-speaking Catholic school. And
that's right.
You spoke only French at home, too?
Yeah, this was in Lisbon, Maine, and everybody spoke French in Lisbon, Maine. They were all French-Canadians who came down from Canada to work in the woolen mills.
And when you moved to California and you started speaking English, do you remember that transition for you?
Yeah, it was tough. You know, as soon as we got to California, I was put in public school, and everybody, of course, spoke English. And I remember a few days later, I just ran away from school. That kind of set me on a different path the rest of my life.
Do you remember where you ran to?
No, I can't even remember that far back.
What are some other examples of your difficulty in adjusting?
Well, you know, in high school was a horror for me. I mean, you know, I had pimples. I was the shortest guy in school. I certainly didn't go to the prom, that's for sure. I was probably down in the bottom of the LA River gigging frogs and catching crawdads. And I mean, I've had a life in nature all my life, really. And it's saved my life.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any friends from your high school years or from your childhood? Or were you?
No.
What did your parents do?
My father was a tradesman. He could build an entire house by himself. He was a plumber, electrician, carpenter, mason, could do everything. Mm. Now, even though he only went to school till third grade, and that was it.
And how about you? When did you stop going to school?
I actually went to 2 years of college, in a junior college in California. At the time, I was working part-time as a private detective. My brother owned a private detective agency, and 18 years old, 19 years old, I was working as a private detective and going to school. But one day, I just was standing in line waiting to get my books for the next semester, and I just walked away, and it's the best thing I've ever done. I think I knew what I wanted to do, which was at that time I was doing a lot of climbing and I wanted to make climbing equipment.
I want to dig into this private investigation, private detective work. What are some cases that you've looked at?
Well, I was mainly working for Howard Hughes. This is when he was hiding out in a Beverly Hills hotel and they were trying to subpoena him. And he had a whole bunch of so-called starlets all around town. And my job was to tail these starlets, and it was just all hanky-panky stuff.
And for those who don't know who Howard Hughes is, who is Howard Hughes?
Well, he was a Hollywood mogul. He was a pilot. He was quite a character. But in his later years, he was pretty crazy, and he did a lot of crazy things, which required a lot of private detectives.
But your calling was in the wilderness.
Yeah, that's right.
We talk about falconry being the genesis of all this. What does falconry have to do with rock climbing?
Well, I learned to climb by climbing to falcons' eyries.
Eyries are the homes of falcons?
Yeah, that's the nest. Okay. Up on cliffs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that's how I learned to climb, you know, using old manila ropes and not really knowing what we were doing, because there was no schools on climbing in those days. You had to learn the hard way, taking a lot of risk and barely coming out alive. Training falcons got me interested a lot in kind of Zen Buddhism philosophy. And my first lesson was basically trying to train a wild falcon. And you trap one and you put it on your fist and you put these jessies on his feet. And you try to stay up all night with him until he finally falls asleep. And that builds trust in the bird very quickly. But, you know, the Zen master has got to say, you know, who's getting trained here? You know, you got a 12-year-old kid having to stay up all night until this bird finally falls asleep.
So you developed this interest in rock climbing because you wanted to go to the nests of these falcons.
That's right.
At the time, this is in the late 40s, early 50s, there was no infrastructure for climbing. What equipment did you use?
Well, we used, I mean, in the beginning, we used, you know, Converse tennis shoes to climb in. There were no climbing shoes. Then we started getting some equipment from Europe, and specifically pitons, you know, the spikes that you drive into the rocks. And in those days, the pitons were made out of soft steel because the European attitude towards climbing was to conquer the mountains and make them easier for the next party. You know, that's kind of the manifest destiny that created America, really. You know, tame the wilderness. But we were brought up with the philosophy of John Muir and Thoreau and Emerson and, you know, the American naturists who believe that you shouldn't alter nature and just you should go into nature and leave no trace of having been there. So I wanted to make some pitons out of hard steel and so that you could use them over and over. And they worked really, really well.
And this was when you were roughly 19, 20 years old.
That's right.
You became essentially a blacksmith.
I borrowed some money from my folks and went out and bought an anvil and a coal-fired forge and got some steel from the junkyard and pounded out my first pitons. And I used them for myself, and then friends wanted some, and then friends of friends, and then pretty soon we were on the cutting edge of rock climbing, climbing these huge walls in Yosemite, you know, that take 10 days. And in fact, you had to have my equipment if you were going to do that climb. You know, I've been a craftsman all my life, kind of, and I love working with my hands. And I love looking at a product and saying, you know, I can make that better. I'm not an inventor, but I'm an innovator.
You mentioned Yosemite. You also would hide out in Yosemite when you you were overstaying your visit. What was that about?
Well, you're only allowed to, in those days, to spend 2 weeks in Yosemite. Well, you can't do much climbing in 2 weeks. Some of those climbs we were doing would be on the wall for 10 days. And so, you know, we'd spend months there. So we were outlaws. We were basically hiding, living in the boulder fields. And
eating what?
Well, I remember 1958, I guess, I took off for the summer And I stopped by this store in San Francisco that sold damaged cans. And I bought cases of damaged cat food and 10 cents a can. And, you know, I spent the summer eating porcupines and ground squirrels and whatever I could scavenge. Mm. I mean, that's what we did.
So here you are. You're pioneering all this equipment for the rock climbing industry out of necessity. Where did it go from there?
Well, it turned into a business. I mean, and it wasn't just rock climbing equipment. I mean, we kind of reinvented all the ice climbing gear. In fact, the stuff was so advanced, so ahead of its time that nobody even knew how to use it. So that was the first book I wrote. I had to write a book on how to ice climb, which kind of revolutionized ice climbing.
You were producing objects that literally supported your life, and mm-hmm. that requires a good deal of confidence. I would never trust myself mm-hmm. to build a device that really had my life in its hands. How did you feel about that?
Well, we were very careful, and at the time I had a partner, Tom Frost, and the two of us were designing and making this stuff. We were the only ones that did all the quality control and everything. I would take buckets of these pitons or carabiners or other tools at home and do all the inspection and quality control myself. And we had an attitude of making the absolute best climbing gear in the world. That was our philosophy.
And the name of your company was Chouinard Equipment.
That's right.
You were pioneering this equipment, but at the same time, you were harming the rocks, even though you were reusing the pitons.
Yeah. You know, when I first started climbing, there was only maybe 250 serious climbers in America. But in the 70s, the sport kind of exploded, and more climbers doing the same routes over and over again, and they're putting in these hard steel pitons in the cracks and taking them out. And pretty soon we were realizing that it's leaving a big hole in the crack. So I felt that, okay, this is our fault. And so I felt, okay, since it's our fault, we need to be the ones to do something about it. And so we put at risk 80% of our sales in pitons and switched over almost overnight to a different method of protecting climbing by these little aluminum chocks that you put into the a constriction in the crack with your fingers, and you pull it out with your fingers, and it causes no harm whatsoever.
And when you're on these climbs, what part of your interest in climbing is the physical versus wanting some solitary moments?
Well, I don't think solitary has much to do with it, but I think you know, the purpose of climbing is to affect some sort of spiritual or physical growth, and it has everything to do with how you get up there. Well, like if you climb in Yosemite, you get to the top of a 10-day climb, and there's nothing there. There's just the forest, and that kind of is the opposite of, say, some high-powered businessman paying $85,000 to be guided up Mount Everest. And what's important to him is to get to the top, not how you get to the top. And that's wrong. That's not what climbing is about.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yvonne Chouinard, founder of Patagonia. We'll hear more from Yvonne coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Andy Levine, co-founder of Sixth Man, a travel company focused on creating unique music events for music fans. Sixth Man organizes cruises that feature concerts with artists including John Mayer, Sarah McLachlan, Lynyrd Skynyrd, and Bare Naked Ladies. By spending a few days on a boat, fans receive a more direct experience with their favorite bands. Andy started Sixth Man in 2001 when he was 30 years old, and more than 30,000 fans have attended a concert cruise hosted by Sixth Man. Welcome.
Thank you.
Where did you come up with the name Sixth Man?
When I was in high school, I played basketball, and I wasn't the starter, but I was what they call the sixth man. It refers to, in basketball, the first man off the bench. They're not a starter, but they play a lot during the game, normally a utility player. And on my high school basketball team, that's what I was. I wasn't tall enough or good enough to start, but I often came off the bench when someone was hurt or in foul trouble, and really I was the hustler. And then when I got to college, I joined a band, and I wasn't very good at guitar, but I booked all the gigs. And so, again, there was this parallel starting to develop in my life. And then I began managing a band, and my focus was almost 100% on the relationship between the band and their fans, who I considered like their sixth man. So when I needed a name, I felt like sixth man was the consistent theme in my life, where I was the happiest and doing the best, the most impactful was when I was playing that role. So it made sense.
You grew up in Nashville, Tennessee. Your dad was an insurance broker, and your mom ran a shopping mall. How did you get the music bug?
My dad played guitar with my uncles. They would just play on the weekends and stuff, nothing professionally. So I was always around it, and my family was really into it. I think it wasn't until I got to the University of Florida that I was in college. You know, that's when you're most likely to join a band, I guess. And so I just, you know, I guess something just came alive, and I wanted to play guitar, and I learned, and there you go.
What role did you play in the band?
I played acoustic guitar and harmonica. And then the big joke was that they didn't have me plugged in for the first year I was in the band. I didn't know that, right? Because I'm on stage, and, you know, it's often the artist can't hear what the audience hears. And they used to play a joke, and they'd be like, Andy, take a solo. And they all knew, and I would be back there, you know, doing this stuff. And the audience was looking at you like a puppy dog, you know, like, what's going on?
So if they thought that you weren't even talented enough to be plugged in, why did they want you in the band?
Because I booked all the gigs. I did all the work. You know, they felt like they were in a arena rock band because they just showed up and it was all ready to go. They used to say it's Andy Levine on rhythm guitar and PR. that was my introduction.
Did you ever think about doing something other than music promotion or music, anything related to music?
I think that I probably would have wanted to be like a coach of some sort, or maybe even a teacher. I was kind of just waiting for my entrepreneurial spirit to strike out. And I have some great instances I can remember where that happened.
What are some instances of your entrepreneurial expressions growing up?
Well, I remember when I was 16, I decided I wanted to start a company called Bagels on Wheels. I felt like people would want to have bagels and donuts delivered to their door every Saturday morning, and I figured out a way where I could make a good living doing that, and then I couldn't get anyone to sign up for that to be a customer, so that didn't work.
So here you are, your band is not successful enough for you to make a living at it, and you end up in Florida at a record store?
I was working as a club called Rickenbacker's, actually, and it was it was a small club that was not doing very well. And being in the band, I had been to different colleges around the Southeast and noticed they had a pretty vibrant or thriving live original music scene where bands were playing, getting paid to play their own songs. And there were some bands that were really successful, like Hootie and the Blowfish and Dave Matthews and Edwin McCain at the time. And so I felt like no one was doing that at the University of Florida, yet here we were in Florida, very desirable, lots of kids or lots of students. And so I asked this club owner, I said, hey, let me try to bring some of these bands in. And he said, all right, let's try it. And he said, how much do you want? I said, I don't want anything. I want half the profit. I want no salary. Mm-hmm. And we had a good time.
You were promoting these concerts at mm-hmm. the University of Florida, and then you became a manager for bands like Creed and Sister Hazel. You had a pretty intimate relationship with Sister Hazel. How did you go about launching Sixth Man and your first cruise concert?
It wasn't until 2001 and focusing on building the street team for Sister Hazel, which is the unit, their army that promotes them, you know, leads the grassroots charge. Those bands, those fans kind of demanded a convention with the band. They felt like they had done everything we'd asked them to do to help promote the bands, let us sleep on their couch, put up flyers, you know, call radio stations, buy the CDs, come to shows, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, yeah, they're right. They have done all those things. And so I went to the band and I said, guys, we got to do something for our street team. They've done everything. They've been amazing. And they said, let's do something. So we did a cruise in 2001 and we just invited 400 fans and we were scared to death. Mm-hmm. And some of the people in the company didn't even go because they're like, Andy, the band's going to fire us for trapping them on the ship with their fans. And I said, you know what? I'm not impressed with the music business right now anyway. If that's the way it's going to go down, then let it be. You know, I had nothing to lose. As soon as we get on the ship, I told the guys, we're going to buy drinks for the fans for an hour and a half. You're going to have a Sharpie. We're going to make a toast to the fans. And I want you to walk around and sign everything you can and take every picture. Don't let them come to you. go do it. Just go work the room.
Because the fans helped promote them.
They did. And I'm glad we did that because that really worked. And it set the tone. It said, hey, we appreciate what you've done. Let's have a great time. It's just us. We're out in the ocean. This is the essence of the music business, the bands and their fans on vacation. I got off the cruise and I felt like I had forgot I was in the music business. That's how pure it was. And so I said, I want to build this. This is it. And I called a few other managers that had bands similar to Sister Hazel, who had 400 or 500 fans. I said, I have this idea. We just did something really cool. Would you guys consider doing it? And they said, you get the whole ship and we'll be there. Well, then I realized you need $750,000 to get a ship for a weekend. A year in advance.
If you're reserving the whole ship, then you need $750,000.
Up front. So when we wanted to go from 400 people to the 2,000 people that it would take to do a full ship charter, the cruise line wasn't really sympathetic to my needs because here I was as some guy with an idea, and I'm sure they get that all the time. In fact, now I know they get that all the time. What I decided to do was, after I talked to those other bands, their managers that said they'd be there if we got the whole ship, then we put up a website and we started promoting the fact that we wanted people just let us know if they'd be interested. So we kind of left it open and we said, if you put a $99 refundable deposit down, that'll give us a way to gauge interest. And we got 1,000 people to put a $99 deposit down. And we figured our break even was right around $1,600 or $1,500. So I took that data and I found two local businessmen in Atlanta who kind of loved what we did, and, you know, loved our spirit and probably could identify with it a bit because they were entrepreneurs themselves. And they loaned me $750,000. I remember two things about this. I remember going to the guy's house to get the check, and I was looking around at his wife and family. I said, how much money do you have to write a 30-year-old a $750,000 check? Because certainly this isn't your last $750,000. You know, what is it? The second thing was that once he gave us the money, I noticed after the first day, there was like a 3 or 4 day gap before we had to wire it to the cruise line. And I noticed we were making like $250 a day in interest. And, you know, at the time I was like, wow, that's a lot of money. I mean, that's more than we make on any day. And that's just for doing nothing. So I just remember like it was my first dealing with that kind of sum of things. And looking back, it was crazy. I mean, why he did it was just crazy. It doesn't make sense why he did it. And we ended up, I think we made $42,000 the first year.
So what is the answer to that question? If somebody's just going to write you a $750,000 check because he likes what you're doing, how much is that person worth?
I think he was worth about $15 million at the time.
How did this individual make his money?
He built a company that offers services to the auto industry, etched glass, extended warranties. And he had sold his company to Ford. Fast forward 5 years, he bought it back from Ford in 2008. And I think he bought it back for less than he sold it for. So
I notice on your site you talk about living loud. Like that's part of your mantra for Sixth Man is live loud. I'm wondering if that naturally cuts off a certain demographic. What is the demographic of your base?
Well, live loud to us is basically identifying what your passion is and pushing it as far as you can while still being responsible to the rest of your life. We've done cruises, like you said, with Elvis. We've done cruises with Kid Rock, John Mayer. And the one thing I'll tell you, and you have to see this to believe it, is that everyone that steps on that ship, whether they're 25 years old or they're 65 years old, they have the exact same attitude and approach to life. And they're not going to bed early. And we're making sure that, you know, we got people, I mean, they're living. And they've come in there for one reason. They've saved up all year or whatever it is. And they are there to celebrate this passion. It's the purest form of your passion.
And it's a huge party for 3 days on a ship.
You know, I always tell people there's three crowds you can run with. There's the crowd that's going to run all day. And if you want to jump in there and try to run with them, go for it. There's the crowd that'll, you know, they'll stay up till 12 midnight and they'll push a little bit. And there's the crowd that just, you know, they keep a normal balancing. They're in the gym in the morning. They see, do a couple of things, have a nice dinner, see a show, but they're in bed. So you just kind of pick your crowd.
And what crowd are you in?
You know, I started in the Top Gun, you know, the first 4 or 5 years. So I started out there, and now I'm a little more in the middle crowd, I would say.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Andy Levine, co-founder of Sixth Man, a travel company focused on creating unique musical events for music fans. Andy started Sixth Man in 2001. You have a blog on the Sixth Man website, and you spoke recently about starting your own company, and you talk about the dip, a term by Seth Godin, the author. You're talking about whether you quit when you're running some type of endeavor or you stick it out. You said that average kills you and horrible saves you. What do you mean by that?
Well, Seth Godin, I've read some of his books over the last few years, and as of late, there's a book he wrote called Tribes, and then he had another book called The Dip, which is like saying it's okay to quit. Like, don't beat your head against the wall. I have a father-in-law who's in this situation where he's running a print store. He's been doing it for 20 years. Nothing has changed. I see him, you know, twice a year. We go to lunch, and I have the same conversation. I said, "Why are you doing it? You know, what's going to make you change?" And so I feel like it's kind of like I was in the band. I feel like people get stuck in it, whether it's relationships or jobs or, you know, ventures or whatever it is. An average can confuse you. Whereas if you're horrible, like my donut, Bagels on Wheels, where I got no customers, it was pretty easy. Or horrible, like the first girl I ever kissed, she's now a nun. That's horrible. See, if it had been okay, you know what? We might have dated, and it would have taken us a long time to realize we weren't for each other. There are some moments where it's just appropriate to say, this isn't working. And or, you know, at least hold yourself accountable to say, I'm going to keep going.
Did you ever face any of those moments while you were launching Six Men? Like, okay, is this kind of just average? And should I just kind of quit or stick it out? Or, boy, this is going well. Like, where was your mind as you were launching the company?
That's a great question. I think every entrepreneur has to, like, experience this. I can remember one time after doing the cruise for a couple of years as a charter, we were growing, but it was still a tremendous undertaking and tremendous risk, and we hadn't figured out a way to get the return out of it. But I didn't really care. You know, I could see it. I could see us getting better and better, and I could see the people coming back, and I could see something there. But the other people that were involved, the investors, were starting to wonder, where's the return? And so there was actually a meeting about whether to do it or not. I'm like, guys, let's just do it one more year. We can do this, you know. And so we did. And sure enough, that was the year that it kind of tipped. You know, we put this event on sale, and for the first time, it sold out way in advance. The irony in all this is that we were doing it in the fall out of New Orleans. We had one scheduled. We sold it out almost a year in advance. All we had to do was push off, execute, come back, and it would have been a very profitable venture. And 3 weeks before we were supposed to sail, Katrina hit New Orleans. And Carnival leased our ship to FEMA. FEMA, I don't know if you remember, they did the housing on there, and they used cruise lines. So I get a call from Carnival one day that says, hey, we're not going to be able to do your program. It's the only, you have to understand, like, I just found out my wife was pregnant with our second child. There was so much pressure for this event to work. And now it was pretty much, we were out of business. So some way I sat down, I wrote a letter to Carnival, and I just kind of outlined all the things we had done and how important it was for them to get us a ship or help figure out a way to make this right. And sure enough, after a couple conversations, it ended up going to the president of the company. And I think they really connected with what we were trying to do. And they, I don't know how they did it, but I got a phone call saying, hey, you know, you're right. And we're going to not only give you the money back that you paid for the ship, but we're going to help you recover all of your expenses and your profit. So, you know, that was a moment. Now, at the same time, you have to understand is that our guest, we had to notify our guest. And so what happened was we started getting phone calls and emails from guests saying, keep my money. Just don't go out of business. I look forward to this all year long. Please. I've met so many great friends. My new best friends I met on this cruise. That's when I knew, like, this is a real family we're building here.
So talk to me about the experience of being on the boat with one of the artists. Let's say John Mayer, for example. You know, I would imagine that the artist is exhausted after playing one night, you know, and the last thing they probably want to do is eat eggs with the fans in the morning when they wake up. And here they have to do it for, you know, 4 days, 5, sometimes 7 days. Was there ever any of that concern?
Well, it is. It's still to this day. It's the thing that everyone says, whoa, wait a minute. I'm trapped on a ship for 4 days, you know. But John Mayer, when he first got on the cruise, I don't think he even knew what he was getting into. I think his manager said, hey, let's try this. It'd be great. And he probably said, yeah, whatever. And he didn't think about it. But for John, he got on. I remember we were sailing out. He said, this is genius. He goes, this is genius. He goes, you know, the whole world may think I'm an arrogant jackass, but I'm going to show these people who I really am, because these are the people that care. These are the people that I want to show who I am. And he spent the next 4 days doing just that. He was in the disco every night DJing, and he's a horrible DJ. But he's pouring tequila shots for people. And you know what? People love that. Just watching him have a good time.
It sounds almost like a religious experience for you. Are you religious?
I am. We go to a church in Atlanta called Buckhead Church, and it's about just growing in your relationship, you know, with Jesus. And I feel like since my wife and I have been going there for the last 3 or 4 years, it's really been a really great centering thing for us.
But while you do go to, you know, a traditional church every Sunday, do you feel like these events on these ships are church-like, you know, getting a whole community of people together? And is there any of that for you, a spiritual component to
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. I know for a fact that the energy that is created and the moments that are had for people, they have to compete at that level. We have guests send us the letters we get. We have guests send, they send us gifts. They send us lunch. There is some sort of exchange going, and a pure exchange that we're given and they're giving back.
We talk about these highlights on the cruises. What are some events that have happened that you might not want to talk about?
We had a situation with Kid Rock where we were supposed to go to Grand Cayman, and the weather wasn't looking great in Grand Cayman, so we decided the day we left to go to the Bahamas instead. The challenge was there was two couples that were supposed to get married in Grand Cayman, and they had family flying to Grand Cayman. I'm happy to say we figured out a way to get those people married in the Bahamas. Well, one of the couples, the guy pulled me aside and said, maybe this is a sign, so he didn't want to get married. But the other couple, we were able to get them married in the Bahamas. And in addition to that, at Kid Rock's Q&A on Sunday, and the last question was, hey, Kid Rock, we'd follow you anywhere, even if it means the Bahamas and missing our wedding in Grand Cayman. Can we get a picture with our best man? And so all of a sudden, he says, get on down here, you know. So he takes this picture. So now these guys have a picture of them with Kid Rock in the middle with his arms around them. And behind them is 2,000 people out on a deck on a Sunday afternoon. That's better than any wedding they would have had in Grand Cayman. And I don't even know what they had planned. So I'm saying, like, that story happens on every cruise, one or two of them.
I'm just curious, you're such a music lover. What kind of music do you listen to when you're in your car or with your family?
The things that will never go away, like the James Taylor, Jackson Browne, the things that I just really just a lot. Those are my dreams. I mean, if I can get James Taylor or Jackson Browne on a cruise, like, that's going to be like the holy grail for me. Sarah McLachlan was that when she decided to come on the cruise, because we did a cruise with the Bare Naked Ladies and their friends, and she said, hey, I want to go on vacation. So she came and performed. And I remember meeting her and seeing her play, and she's just as pure an entertainer as it gets and a singer. She's just so good.
I would have never pegged you as a James Taylor or Sarah McLachlan fan.
Well, if it wasn't for James Taylor, I would not be sitting here right now, because he's the artist that made me want to pick up the guitar. But James Taylor was the drive that kept me up all night learning how to play guitar and hurt until my fingers bled. It still wasn't good enough to be plugged in, by the way. So, you know, glad I could shock you.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been Andy Levine, co-founder of Sixth Man. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Andy Levine, co-founder of Sixth Man, a travel company focused on creating unique music events for music fans. Sixth Man organizes cruises that feature concerts with artists including John Mayer, Sarah McLachlan, Lynyrd Skynyrd, and Bare Naked Ladies. By spending a few days on a boat, fans receive a more direct experience with their favorite bands. Andy started Sixth Man in 2001 when he was 30 years old, and more than 30,000 fans have attended a concert cruise hosted by Sixth Man. Welcome.
Thank you.
Where did you come up with the name Sixth Man?
When I was in high school, I played basketball, and I wasn't the starter, but I was what they call the sixth man. It refers to, in basketball, the first man off the bench. They're not a starter, but they play a lot during the game, normally a utility player. And on my high school basketball team, that's what I was. I wasn't tall enough or good enough to start, but I often came off the bench when someone was hurt or in foul trouble, and really I was the hustler. And then when I got to college, I joined a band, and I wasn't very good at guitar, but I booked all the gigs. And so, again, there was this parallel starting to develop in my life. And then I began managing a band, and my focus was almost 100% on the relationship between the band and their fans, who I considered like their sixth man. So when I needed a name, I felt like Sixth Man was the consistent theme in my life, where I was the happiest and doing the best, the most impactful was when I was playing that role. So it made sense.
you grew up in Nashville, Tennessee. Your dad was an insurance broker and your mom ran a shopping mall. How did you get the music bug?
My dad played guitar with my uncles. They would just play on the weekends and stuff, nothing professionally. So I was always around it, and my family was really into it. I think it wasn't until I got to the University of Florida that I was in college. You know, that's when you're most likely to join a band, I guess. And so I guess something just came alive, and I wanted to play guitar, and I learned, and there you go.
What role did you play in the band?
I played acoustic guitar and harmonica. And then the big joke was that they didn't have me plugged in for the first year I was in the band. I didn't know that, right? Because I'm on stage and, you know, it's often the artist can't hear what the audience hears. And they used to play a joke where they'd be like, Andy, take a solo. And they all knew. And I would be back there, you know, doing this stuff. And the audience is looking at you like a puppy dog, you know, like, what's going on?
So if they thought that you weren't even talented enough to be plugged in, why did they want you in the band?
Because I booked all the gigs. I did all the work. You know, they felt like they were in a arena rock band because they just showed up and it was all ready to go. They used to say it's Andy Levine on rhythm guitar and PR. that was my introduction.
Did you ever think about doing something other than music promotion or music, anything related to music?
I think that I probably would have wanted to be like a coach of some sort, or maybe even a teacher. I was kind of just waiting for my entrepreneurial spirit to strike out. And I have some great instances I can remember where that happened.
What are some instances of your entrepreneurial expressions growing up?
Well, I remember when I was 16, I decided I wanted to start a company called Bagels on Wheels. I felt like people would want to have bagels and donuts delivered to their door every Saturday morning, and I figured out a way where I could make a good living doing that, and then I couldn't get anyone to sign up for that to be a customer, so that didn't work.
So here you are, your band is not successful enough to for you to make a living at it, and you end up in Florida at a record store?
I was working as a club called Rickenbacker's, actually, and it was a small club that was not doing very well. And being in the band, I had been to different colleges around the Southeast and noticed they had a pretty vibrant or thriving live original music scene where bands were playing, getting paid to play their own songs. And there were some bands that were really successful, like Hootie and the Blowfish and Dave Matthews and Edwin McCain at the time. And so I felt like no one was doing that at the University of Florida yet. Here we were in Florida, very desirable, lots of kids or lots of students. And so I asked this club owner, I said, hey, let me try to bring some of these bands in. And he said, all right, let's try it. And he said, how much do you want? I said, I don't want anything. I want half the profit. I want no salary. Mm-hmm. And we had a good time.
You were promoting these concerts at mm-hmm. the University of Florida, and then you became a manager for bands like Creed and Sister Hazel. You had a pretty intimate relationship with Sister Hazel. How did you go about launching Six Man and your first cruise concert?
It wasn't until 2001 and focusing on building the street team for Sister Hazel, which is the unit, their army that promotes them, you know, leads the grassroots charge. Those bands, those fans kind of demanded a convention with the band. They felt like they had done everything we'd asked them to do to help promote the bands, let us sleep on their couch, put up flyers, you know, call radio stations, buy the CDs, come to shows, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, yeah, they're right. They have done all those things. And so I went to the band and I said, guys, we got to do something for our street team. They've done everything. They've been amazing. And they said, let's do something. So we did a cruise in 2001 and we just invited 400 fans and we were scared to death. Mm-hmm. And some of the people in the company didn't even go because they're like, Andy, the band's going to fire us for trapping them on the ship with their fans. And I said, you know what? I'm not impressed with the music business right now anyway. If that's the way it's going to go down, then let it be. You know, I had nothing to lose. As soon as we get on the ship, I told the guys, we're going to buy drinks for the fans for an hour and a half. You're going to have a Sharpie. We're going to make a toast to the fans. And I want you to walk around and sign everything you can and take every picture. Don't let them come to you. Go do it. Just go work the room.
Because the fans help promote them.
They did. And I'm glad we did that because that really worked. And it set the tone. It said, hey, we appreciate what you've done. Let's have a great time. It's just us. We're out in the ocean. This is the essence of the music business, the bands and their fans on vacation. I got off the cruise and I felt like I had forgot I was in the music business. That's how pure it was. And so I said, I want to build this. This is it. And I called a few other managers that had bands similar to Sister Hazel, who had 400 or 500 fans. I said, I have this idea. We just did something really cool. Would you guys consider doing it? And they said, you get the whole ship and we'll be there. Well, then I realized you need $750,000 to get a ship for a weekend. a year in advance.
If you're reserving the whole ship, then you need $750,000.
Up front. So when we wanted to go from 400 people to the 2,000 people that it would take to do a full ship charter, the cruise line wasn't really sympathetic to my needs, because here I was as some guy with an idea, and I'm sure they get that all the time. In fact, now I know they get that all the time. What I decided to do was, after I had talked to those other bands, their managers that said they'd be there if we got the whole ship, then we put up a website and we started promoting the fact that we wanted people to let us know if they'd be interested. So we kind of left it open, and we said, if you put a $99 refundable deposit down, that'll give us a way to gauge interest. And we got 1,000 people to put a $99 deposit down. And we figured our break-even was right around $1,600 or $1,500. So I took that data, and I found two local businessmen in Atlanta who kind of loved what we did, and, you know, loved our spirit, and probably could identify with it a bit because they were entrepreneurs themselves. And they loaned me $750,000. I remember two things about this. I remember going to the guy's house to get the check, and I was looking around, his wife and family. I said, how much money do you have to write a 30-year-old a $750,000 check? Because certainly this isn't your last $750,000. You know, what is it? The second thing was that once he gave us the money, I noticed after the first day, there was like a 3 or 4 day gap before we had to wire to the cruise line. And I noticed we were making like $250 a day in interest. And, you know, at the time I was like, wow, that's a lot of money. I mean, that's more than we make on any day. And that's just for doing nothing. So I just remember, like, it was my first dealing with that kind of sum of things. And looking back, it was crazy. I mean, why he did it was just crazy. It doesn't make sense why he did it. And we ended up, I think we made $42,000 the first year.
So what is the answer to that question? If somebody's just going to write you a $750,000 check because he likes what you're doing, how much is that person worth?
I think he was worth about $15 million at the time.
How did this individual make his money?
He built a company that offers services to the auto industry, Edge Class, extended warranties. And he had sold his company to Ford. Fast forward 5 years, he bought it back from Ford in 2008. And I think he bought it back for less than he sold it for. So,
I notice on your site you talk about living loud. Like, that's part of your mantra for Six Man, is live loud. I'm wondering if that naturally cuts off a certain demographic. What is the demographic of your base?
Well, live loud to us is basically identifying what your passion is and pushing it as far as you can while still being responsible to the rest of your life. We've done cruises, like you said, with Elvis. We've done cruises with Kid Rock, John Mayer. And the one thing I'll tell you, and you have to see this to believe it, is that everyone that steps on that ship, whether they're 25 years old or they're 65 years old, they have the exact same attitude and approach to life. And they're not going to bed early. And we're making sure that, you know, we got people, I mean, they're living. And they've come in there for one reason. They've saved up all year or whatever it is. And they are there to celebrate this passion. It's the purest form of your passion.
And it's a huge party for 3 days on a ship.
I always tell people there's three crowds you can run with. There's the crowd that's going to run all day. And if you want to jump in there and try to run with them, go for it. There's the crowd that'll, you know, they'll stay up till 12 midnight and they'll push a little bit. And there's the crowd that just, you know, they keep a normal balancing. They're in the gym in the morning. They do a couple of things, have a nice dinner, see a show, but they're in bed. So you just got to pick your crowd.
And what crowd are you in?
You know, I started in the Top Gun, you know, the first 4 or 5 years. So I started out there, and now I'm a little more in the middle crowd, I would say.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Andy Levine, co-founder of Sixth Man, a travel company focused on creating unique musical events for music fans. Andy started Sixth Man in 2001. You have a blog on the Sixth Man website, and you spoke recently about starting your own company, and you talk about the dip, a term by Seth Godin, the author. You're talking about whether you quit when you're running some type of endeavor or you stick it out. You said that average kills you and horrible saves you. What do you mean by that?
Well, Seth Godin, I've read some of his books over the last few years, and as of late, there's a book he wrote called Tribes, and then he had another book called The Dip, which is like saying it's okay to quit. Like, don't beat your head against the wall. I have a father-in-law who's in this situation where he's running a print store. He's been doing it for 20 years. Nothing has changed. I see him, you know, twice a year. We go to lunch, and I have the same conversation. I said, why are you doing it? You know, what's going to make you change? And so I feel like it's kind of like I was in the band. I feel like people get stuck in it, whether it's relationships or jobs or, you know, ventures or whatever it is. An average can confuse you. Whereas if you're horrible, like my donut bagels on wheels, where I got no customers, it was pretty easy. Or horrible, like the first girl I ever kissed, she's now a nun. That's horrible. See, if it had been okay, you know what? We might have dated, and it would have taken us a long time to realize we weren't for each other. There are some moments where it's just appropriate to say, this isn't working. Or, you know, at least hold yourself accountable to say, I'm going to keep going.
Did you ever face any of those moments while you were launching Six Men? Like, okay, is this kind of just average and should I just kind of quit or stick it out? Or, boy, this is going well. Like, where was your mind as you were launching the company?
That's a great question. I think every entrepreneur has to, like, experience this. I can remember one time after doing the cruise for a couple of years as a charter, we were growing, but it was still a tremendous undertaking and tremendous risk, and we hadn't figured out a way to get the return out of it. But I didn't really care. You know, I could see it. I could see us getting better and better, and I could see the people coming back, and I could see something there. But the other people that were involved, the investors, were starting to wonder, where's the return? And so there was actually a meeting about whether to do it or not. And I'm like, guys, let's just do it one more year. We can do this, you know. And so we did. And sure enough, that was the year that it kind of tipped. You know, we put this event on sale, and for the first time, it sold out way in advance. The irony in all this is that we were doing it in the fall out of New Orleans. We had one scheduled. We sold it out almost a year in advance. All we had to do was push off, execute, come back, and it would have been a very profitable venture. And 3 weeks before we were supposed to sail, Katrina hit New Orleans. And Carnival leased our ship to FEMA. FEMA, I don't know if you remember, they did the housing on there and they used cruise lines. So I get a call from Carnival one day that says, hey, we're not going to be able to do your program. It's the only, you have to understand, like, I just found out my wife was pregnant with our second child. There was so much pressure for this event to work. And now it was pretty much, we were out of business. So some way I sat down, I wrote a letter to Carnival, and I just kind of outlined all the things we had done and how important it was for them to get us a ship or help figure out a way to make this right. And sure enough, after a couple conversations, I ended up going to the president of the company, and I think they really connected with what we were trying to do, and they, I don't know how they did it, but I got a phone call saying, hey, you know, you're right, and we're going to not only give you the money back that you paid for the ship, but we're going to help you recover all of your expenses and your profit. So, you know, that was a moment. Now, at the same time, you have to understand is that our guest, we had to notify our guest, and so what happened was we started getting phone calls and emails from guests saying, keep my money. Just don't go out of business. I look forward to this all year long. Please. I've met so many great friends. My new best friends I met on this cruise. That's when I knew, like, this is a real family we're building here.
So talk to me about the experience of being on the boat with one of the artists. Let's say John Mayer, for example. You know, I would imagine that the artist is exhausted after playing one night, you know, and the last thing they probably want to do is eat eggs with the fans in the morning when they wake up. And here they have to do it for, you know, 4 days, 5, sometimes 7 days. Was there ever any of that concern?
Well, it is. It's still to this day. It's the thing that everyone says, whoa, wait a minute. I'm trapped on a ship for 4 days, you know. But John Mayer, when he first got on the cruise, I don't think he even knew what he was getting into. I think his manager said, hey, let's try this. It'd be great. And he probably said, yeah, whatever. And he didn't think about it. But for John, he got on. I remember we were sailing out. He said, this is genius. He goes, this is genius. He goes, you know, the whole world may think I'm an arrogant jackass, but I'm going to show these people who I really am, because these are the people that care. These are the people that I want to show who I am. And he spent the next 4 days doing just that. He was in the disco every night DJing, and he's a horrible DJ. But he's pouring tequila shots for people. And you know what? People love that. Just watched him have a good time.
It sounds almost like a religious experience for you. Are you religious?
I am. We go to a church in Atlanta called Buckhead Church, and it's about just growing in your relationship, you know, with Jesus. And I feel like since my wife and I have been going there for the last 3 or 4 years, it's really been a really great centering thing for us.
But while you do go to a traditional church every Sunday, do you feel like these events on these ships are church-like, getting a whole community of people together? And is there any of that for you, a spiritual component to
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. I know for a fact that the energy that is created and the moments that are had for people, they have to compete at that level. We have guests send us the letters we get. We have guests send, they send us gifts. They send us lunch. There is some sort of exchange going, and a pure exchange that we're given and they're giving back.
We talk about these highlights on the cruises. What are some events that have happened that you might not want to talk about?
We had a situation with Kid Rock where we were supposed to go to Grand Cayman, and the weather wasn't looking great in Grand Cayman, so we decided the day we left to go to the Bahamas instead. The challenge was there was two couples that were supposed to get married in Grand Cayman, and they had family flying to Grand Cayman. I'm happy to say we figured out a way to get those people married in the Bahamas. Well, one of the couples, the guy pulled me aside and said, maybe this is a sign, so he didn't want to get married. But the other couple, we were able to get them married in the Bahamas. And in addition to that, at Kid Rock's Q&A on Sunday, and the last question was, hey, Kid Rock, we'd follow you anywhere, even if it means the Bahamas and missing our wedding in Grand Cayman. Can we get a picture with our best man? And so all of a sudden, he says, get on down here, So he takes this picture. So now these guys have a picture of them with Kid Rock in the middle with his arms around them. And behind them is 2,000 people out on a deck on a Sunday afternoon. That's better than any wedding they would have had in Grand Cayman. And I don't even know what they had planned. So I'm saying, that story happens on every cruise, one or two of them.
I'm just curious. You're such a music lover. What kind of music do you listen to when you're in your car or with your family?
The things that will never go away, like the James Taylor, Jackson Brown, are things that I just really just a lot. Those are my dreams. I mean, if I can get James Taylor or Jackson Brown on a cruise, that's going to be the holy grail for me. Sarah McLachlan was that when she decided to come on the cruise, because we did a cruise with the Bare Naked Ladies and their friends, and she said, hey, I want to go on vacation. So she came and performed. And I remember meeting her and seeing her play, and she's just as pure an entertainer as it gets and a singer. She's just so good.
I would have never pegged you as a James Taylor or Sarah McLachlan fan.
Well, if it wasn't for James Taylor, I would not be sitting here right now, because he's the artist that made me want to pick up the guitar. But James Taylor was the drive that kept me up all night learning how to play guitar and hurt until my fingers bled. It still wasn't good enough to be plugged in, by the way. So, glad I could shock you.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been Andy Levine, co-founder of Sixth Man. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.